Welcome to episode 20 of the James Murua Literary Podcast. This week's podcast, repurposed from the Thursday, November 12th livestream, features Maaza Mengiste and Antia Ravik Strubel. The podcast is a production by James Murua Literary in cooperation with Frankfurter Buchmesse, with financial support from the German Federal Foreign Office. Enjoy.
Maaza, I mean, I know that you're based in the U.S. right now, but you actually are Ethiopian, and you have followed the industry back in Ethiopia. Do you want to tell us a bit about Ethiopia?
Well, I mean, the Ethiopian literary industry is, there are writers there, there are poets there. There is, I believe, really an explosion of the arts, a renaissance happening in Ethiopia right now. But there is not really an ecosystem that supports writers. Writers are doing this on their own. There's books that my book had to be brought in from the UK into Ethiopia. There's not really a, there's the publishing industry, it is just beginning at this point to really start to grow. And I think that there are people there on the ground working to make that happen. I'm working with certain people to develop more of an outreach for these writers that are based in Ethiopia, and also bringing writers into Ethiopia to have discussions, and all of this is starting to come up. But Ethiopia's history has been a history of, it's been literary, it has one of the oldest written alphabets, but it's also seen a series of civil wars and wars that have limited entire populations of educated people. The Italians came in 1935, and one of the things that they did was make sure that they killed all college-educated people. They wanted to strip that country of education, of any knowledge that would, you know, create some level of greater resistance. The revolution in the 70s did the same thing. College students and high school students and people who are called the elite intelligentsia were wiped out, either through, you know, imprisonment or in exile. So again, it's growing. Now we have this generation that is coming up, and I think that there are real champions on the ground in Ethiopia doing this, and I'm excited and eager to help in any way that I can.
I think I read about this civil war, the 70s in beneath the mm-hmm. The Lion's Gaze. You brought it out there. And you actually were the editor for Addis Ababa Noir. Mm-hmm. How were you able to pull it off? Because if the system doesn't exist the way it exists in other parts of the, like in Germany, how are you able to pull it off?
Well, the publisher is an American publisher. I could find the writers in Ethiopia. I could find them across the diaspora, and that made it possible. But now the book is going to be published, distributed in Ethiopia with an independent publisher in the country. It may take a few years to really get that going, maybe 1 or 2 years to make that happen, but it's going to happen. So that is also something that's exciting.
Oh, that's really, really good to hear. Antia, you mentioned that there's something for translators. You know, that's really working for translators. And I look at your body of work. There's quite a bit of translation. How did you get into this?
How did I get into this? Actually, I discovered a book in a secondhand bookstore. It was called Democracy. And I found it very strange that a novel called Democracy, what a big word for a novel. So I got very curious and started to read it. And I just had read the first page and I was so taken by it that I couldn't stop reading it. It was Joan Didion's novel, Democracy. And I found her so exciting that I really wanted to translate her all of a sudden, because I thought, if I translate her, I really understand her from the depth. I understand what she's doing to achieve this, what I so liked in her writing, this person and timing and rhythm and everything. And then I just found out that the rights to this famous Year of Magical Thinking were bought by Ullstein Publishing House here, and I asked them if I can translate it, and this is how I started. And since then, I was lucky enough to always being able to translate things that I really like, when I really am so excited about the text that I want to find out how it sounds in German when I bring it into the German language. And to me, translation is also something to, or a way to understand myself and my own work better, because in comparison, in this kind of close comparison to another writing style, to another aesthetic concept, it helps me to understand myself. That's why I really like to do it even parallel. Like, I can write in the morning and translate in the afternoon.
And I see you do translations from English and Swedish as well.
Exactly, yeah.
And is there a story? I mean, are you a big fan of ABBA, or how do you?
Is there a story?
Yeah. Why Swedish? I mean, why not Romanian or Hungarian?
good question. I mean, I've been asked it quite a lot. Okay, you think English, everybody can speak English. That's why English is not the question here.
Yes.
Okay, English is easy, but Swedish, yeah, I don't
we
know.
We understand English because of the history. But Swedish, you have to ask questions.
Okay. Swedish, I don't know. I mean, I can't give you a story, but I don't know if that really explains it. In the East, when I was a child, I was always standing with my parents, not always, but like in the summer, standing with my parents at the Baltic Sea, at the shore, and there was this white, glittering, beautiful ferry leaving into the horizon, like going away into the horizon and disappearing behind somewhere. And there was this mysterious country that I couldn't reach. Like, nobody could go there. It was the West, of course. You couldn't go there. So this image of the disappearing paradise, you can say, kind of seduced me to go to Sweden rather soon. And then, I don't know why, when I went there for the first time or second time, I felt like I've lived there before. The nature and the atmosphere, they resonated with me. And I started to get more and more interested in the country. And then I started to learn the language. And I guess that's why. And then I also wanted to read, of course, the literature and the original. And but I don't know if that's the answer. That's maybe one of the answers.
As I know, you write in English, but you speak several European languages.
Just Italian.
So just the Italian.
Yeah.
Have you considered writing in that language?
Not really. You know, a few years ago, I translated or tried to translate just a part of an Italian text. It was a graphic novel. And I was asked if this was something I would be interested in doing. And I thought, you know, these graphic novels don't have many words. So, of course, yeah, I can do this. And once I got started in it, it was probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. Even with these little boxes that had two words, I realized, oh my God, you know, you're not just translating words, you're translating meaning, intent, all the other emotions that came before it. And it was probably one of the more challenging things I have done. And that gave me so much more or renewed respect for translation, because I have so much respect for translators, but to actually work or try to work in the trenches, so to speak, and see how the work gets done was a revelation for me. At times I think, well, maybe I can try to do something really short, and then I remember that experience and I say, I need a lot of time. A lot of time in order to try to do something like that. But I haven't yet written in Italian, but I've been working with my Italian translator for my novel, The Shadow King, very closely. And I have been absolutely thrilled to see the way that the process has developed and how she's working with certain Amharic words into Italian concepts. And that has been really fascinating for me.
Antia, I mean, I just wanted, I mean, for writers, you must talk about conflict. Maza, you seem to have a lot of conflict that you can mine from. I'm interested, Antia, you have this wonderful novel, Tupolev 134, about a hostage situation that came out in 2004. And I'm just, please tell us about this novel, because it sounds really interesting. I started reading a bit about it. And, you know, this is a very interesting conflict that I thought, you know, you want to talk a little bit about.
Yeah, of course. It's the only book I wrote so far that is based on a real story, actually. In 1978, there was a hijacking. Two East Germans hijacked an airplane that was leaving Poland, actually supposed to go back to East Germany. But they hijacked it into West Berlin. And the reason for that was because they wanted to flee with the help of a West German guy who had passports for them. And they were supposed to meet in Poland, in Gdansk. And this guy never came. And these two East Germans are stranded or were stranded in Poland. And they knew if they would fly back to East Germany, probably the Secret Service would be waiting for them, because they were afraid that this West German guy got caught by the Secret Service. So their plans got caught. And so it was just an impulse that they bought a toy gun and hijacked this airplane into the West. And what I found so interesting, besides the fact that I had no idea that this happened, I mean, I was a child when it happened, but I also asked around, nobody remembered this case. And it was a big thing, because it was in the middle of the Cold War. It was a huge conflict, actually, between the Soviets and the Americans, because they were both, they occupied Berlin on both sides. And they were flying this plane into the American zone. And shortly before, there was the Mogadishu hijacking, like this case where the airplane was hijacked to Mogadishu. And the Soviets and the Americans, they agreed to give each other the hijackers.
They exchanged the hijackers.
To exchange their hijackers. But since West Germany said there's no border between East and West, and you can come, you East Germans, you can come over the border anytime, we don't acknowledge this border, it was also a tricky situation. There were so many political interests involved. And there was a court even built on this Tempelhof airport. With the Americans, there was an American judge. There were West Germans involved, but with an American judge. So it was a big case, and I was totally fascinated by that. But then I also asked myself, why? What can I contribute to that? Why would I write about it? I'm not a writer of historical novels. I write more out of my present time. And then I realized it is actually also a question of how do we narrate historical events, like, reinvent historical events by narrating them. And this was my take on this case, how I wrote about it. So I also involved myself into this book, or I'm as a narrator, or I'm as an author, are part of the narration.
Answer yourself. Do you want to? Because I could see you nodding when
you
know the historical.
I mean, I think that act of re-narration is itself. It's sometimes so much of what history is just only parts of the narrative that are shown to us. And so, what you're talking about with that act of re-narrating something is even pulling out details and facts that were never known, you know, in a historical memory. So I find that I mean this is really the main point that I think the main reason I write historical novels is that act of re-narrating something helps to establish or sometimes correct a second history. And that feels like an important reason all on its own. And your story, that story sounds absolutely incredible. I can imagine what it was like to write it, but I also find it fascinating that you've put yourself into the story. So you're both a writer and a character in this work that's historically based and fiction.
Exactly, like in the way of asking how it could have been, and then jumping also back and forth between the different characters and taking on different angles. And you have, and I mean, I like to play with the role of the author in general. So that's nothing. I mean, it is special in this case because it has this historical core or historical center. But to play with the role of the writer or the author is always kind of fun. But here it's also like you have certain scenes and you tell them from different perspectives and they turn into totally different scenes. And you have all these possibilities next to each other. And they're all true, but they're all limited true. And this is what I find interesting. But I mean, in a way, you also develop another or a second or a third truth about something that is probably also already been written about. And now we have another version.
How was it for you, Maza? How did you pick the points in history that you used?
The first novel, 1974, during the revolution, felt like an automatic, a very straightforward choice because there were so many memories that I had of Ethiopia during those early years. And it was one of the reasons that my family had to leave Ethiopia. And I think it's often inevitable for all of us to sit down at some point in our lives and say, how did I get here? What took me? What were all the paths that took me to this place? And for me, it always led back to the revolution. And I had enough knowledge, direct knowledge of it, that I could write that. I had a sense that I wanted to write this story about 1935 as a novel, but I knew that I didn't know how to research yet. I didn't know how to write a book. I didn't know enough about writing, I felt, to tackle that. I wanted to write that second book because my family had been involved in this war. I grew up with stories of the men in my family, but didn't really understand the role of women in it until I started researching. But both of those things were closely connected to my own childhood, so they felt natural to do. And now, when I'm thinking about what's next, I realize that these two were the things that I felt I had to write, and now it feels like my imagination is freed to really go anywhere that I would like it. It's not bound by childhood stories or childhood memories. And that feels like an interesting place to be. Like, who knows what I'll do next.
I know that you need to leave, Maza, and I want to say thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thank you.
So what I'll do is I'll ask each of you to just give a little closing statement of what you've experienced here. What do you think of this kind of an initiative? And I'll start with you, Maza, because you're the one who needs to leave immediately.
Okay. Well, I am really grateful for this opportunity to be in conversation with Antia and to hear more about your work. I'm fascinated by everything that you've said. So I hope that we get a chance to meet in person one day. But this has been an incredibly inspiring moment for me. This conversation has been fantastic. And James, thank you for inviting me to do this. I think we need to have more of these conversations that cross borders, but really bring us together in the many ways that our imaginations intersect. So this is great.
Antia?
I totally agree. I also find it very interesting and fascinating. And I actually had the feeling we just started. So I want to talk a bit more now, and I will be very sad to switch off this computer.
I'm
maybe we can continue. What we can do is you can exchange contacts, and maybe we can have a conversation after the fact.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So in my stake, close, say thank you so much, Maaza and Antia, for agreeing to be on the stream today. I want to say thank you to my partners, Frankfurt Bookmesse, who helped us source the guests, as well as the federal government of Germany, who provided funding for this event. And I'm hoping that both of you have a nice evening. Thank you so much, ladies.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.